Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We stream live on the web at kuci.org. Today's Wednesday, July 17th, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today I'm with literary agent Mark Gottlieb. Mark is a literary agent at Trident Media Group in New York City. Since his time at Trident, he's represented New York Times bestselling as well as award-winning authors. He's also optioned and sold books to film and TV companies. He previously ran Trident Media Group's audio department, and before that, worked in foreign rights. Hey, Mark.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on the show and for that very kind intro.
Of course. Thank you for being here. I don't think most of our listeners know you come from a literary family, and I wonder if you want to talk about that and how you got into agenting.
Sure. It happens to be my family business where I work, so I grew up around book publishing from a very young age, had known a lot of best-selling authors back from when I my childhood, people like Dean Koontz and Janet Ivanovich, Tom Clancy, and many others.
And then how did you find your way there? I mean, was it expected that you would get involved with the business, or did you, in college, decide this is something you really had to do as opposed to whatever other interests you had?
You know, it wasn't always expected because my dad, he used to work at the William Morris Agency. He ran their book department, and he was on the board of directors. And, you know, as a kid, you look up to your parents, you think what they do is really cool, and I always thought, hey, I want to do that. And one day I told him that when I was a kid, and he explained, well, the company has anti-nepotism policies. And so that day I learned what that word meant and assumed I would never work with him until one day in the year 2000, he formed Trident Media Group. And it was at that point, I think I was going into high school, I realized it was an actual possibility that I could one day be working with him.
Interesting. And then I think you went to Emerson, is that so?
That's correct. I went to Emerson College. They offer a study in writing, literature, and book publishing. And I founded a publishing club there and a small press there called Wild Press, which is still operational, and they're producing books every year.
Interesting. Okay. So let's break down some of the genres that you represent. Could you go into that?
I really do. I haven't really narrowed my focus into any one particular or even just a few genres. But if I had to say, you know, what the commonality was among a lot of the books I represent, there's a mixture of commercial fiction, what we in the industry refer to as that, which basically means, you know, a lot of best-selling books, kind of genre, big blockbuster type of books. And then a lot of upmarket fiction, which another industry jargon term, just basically a book where it's sort of at the crossroads of where commercial fiction meets literary fiction. And, you know, I also represent a lot of other books in other areas such as graphic novels, children's books, whether that be young adult, middle grade, or the very occasional picture book. And then on the nonfiction side, I tend to focus on a lot of platform-driven books, which means basically if the author has a very big stage to speak from, or if they're a celebrity and they want to write their memoir, you know, then I'm interested.
What's the difference between commercial and literary and upmarket? Because there seem to be a lot of crossover and confusion in terms of, you know, if an agent reads a work and says, oh, I can't sell this, this is too commercial, or reads the work and says, I can't sell this, this is too literary. What is the difference?
Yeah, I think there are a bunch of distinguishing factors, but maybe to try and help to boil it down, just to focus on a few aspects. I think a lot of commercial fiction tends to be very much so plot-driven. You know, a thriller, for instance, will have a breakneck pace. It will push the reader forward because there's a lot of conflict in the book, a lot of action to hold the reader's attention. And so, whereas there might be some other elements like some character development or things like that, which you would more often associate with maybe literary fiction, I think commercial fiction is really focused on the plot and that story arc, whereas literary fiction, you know, tends to be focused on how floral the writing is, what the characters are going through and how they're changing and the sort of the deeper meaning, and it tends to be a lot less concerned with things like the plot. And then in the case of upmarket fiction, that's sort of where you're really waiting for both feet to drop. You're waiting for the aspects of commercial fiction, like we use the example of plot, and you're waiting for some of the other aspects of literary fiction, like, you know, character development, the strength of the writing by the line, things like that.
Yeah, so say a writer queries you and you know, says my book is this or that. Is that important to you? I mean, do you read a query on the basis of whether the writer defines what he or she is sending you, or are you paying attention to other things in the query letter?
Right. So when an author sends me a query letter or a cover letter, you know, by way of email introducing me to them and their book, I'm looking at a few factors. First of all, the quality of the writing within the letter itself. That's the author's first opportunity to exhibit their writing to me. I'm obviously looking at things like their relevant writing experience, their writing credentials in their author bio and things like that. But, yeah, I'm also looking at the meat and potatoes of the story. Like, if it's commercial fiction in terms of the plot, if it's literary fiction, you know, the same things we discussed before, but I should get a pretty good sense of it from the letter itself rather than the author calling out to me, oh, I'm an author of literary fiction or I'm an author of commercial fiction. It should really speak for itself.
Do you like when writers say, my book is a cross between Stephen King's The Stand and Mavis Gallant's collection of short stories? I don't know, anything like that, some sort of, you know, where they're trying to tell you what you're going to find, or would you rather they just not do that?
That's very helpful, actually. In our industry, that's this process we refer to as assembling comp titles.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically short for comparative or competitive titles, depending on how you look at it. It's as simple as, sort of like you said, my book is this meets that, maybe with a little bit of something else thrown in. And it's a way to immediately place it in our minds, but where that also becomes important is down the line, an editor at a book publishing house is trying to figure out, where will this book go on my list, where will it go in a bookstore, and how well can I expect it to do? So you mentioned Stephen King, obviously. If you compare yourself to one of the masters or just hold yourself in high esteem, that can really help a lot. At the same time, you want to be realistic. You know, you don't want people to roll their eyes. So if you've written a fantasy book, you know, you might not want to compare yourself to the Tolkien right away. And also, in terms of being realistic, the way in which books are written and published, you know, changes over the years. So a title is basically a best-selling book which published within the last 5 years that you feel in some way, some aspect is similar to your book. And obviously, if it's an adult book, you want to compare your book to another adult book, not a children's book or something like that. So to have two or three of those can help.
As opposed to saying you've got your next bestseller on your hands.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't really help anyone.
Right.
I mean, except, you know, it's a statement. And we all want to believe that, but I need to be shown that both on the page in terms of the quality of the writing and maybe in the comp titles too. That helps the process.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Mark Gottlieb. He's an agent at Trident Media Group in New York City. You mentioned memoir earlier, and I hear such conflicting news about memoir. Memoirs, you know, are done for now. On the other hand, memoirs will never be done. So where is the memoir in terms of publishers and in terms of, you know, one comes into your door? What are you looking for in that?
Yeah, memoirs can be tricky because whereas they fit into the category of nonfiction, where a lot of publishers are looking for that author platform I referenced earlier in the show, basically a publisher is thinking to themselves, okay, if this author has a million social media followers, 10% of those people buy the book, then we're in great shape. Or if this author, you know, does speaking engagements across the country throughout the year to big audiences, that's another built-in audience for this book. And so that's why it's oftentimes a no-brainer when if a celebrity, you know, wants to write a book, a publisher is happy to take the risk because they realize they can sell a lot of copies of the book. Whereas if it's just an individual who wants to tell their story and how it was a harrowing journey or something like that, it's much harder to convince a book publisher. I mean, granted, memoir will share a lot of qualities that fiction does in terms of it having a narrative aspect, which is one of the reasons why I find that personal memoir needs to be sold on a full manuscript more often than other types of nonfiction, which tend to be need to be sold on a proposal basis, like a few sample chapters accompanied with a book proposal. I think there was a time, like you referred to before, where personal memoir was booming. You had people like Cheryl Strayed writing books like Wild and things like that, where ordinary people who come out of the blogosphere or, you know, write a personal memoir and get it published. But that space has become crowded.
So are credentials as important, credentials and platform, are they as important in fiction as in nonfiction?
The distinguishing factor between fiction and nonfiction is really that at the end of the day, fiction is all about quality of the writing and the author becoming a household name by extension of that. You know, it helps, obviously, if a writer can say that they have endorsements or blurbs from best-selling authors for their book, or, you know, that they attended a prestigious MFA program or anything like that. Those are bells and whistles, and they definitely help. In the case of nonfiction, it's primarily platform-driven. So, again, like what we discussed, the how big their reach, their audiences, how many, you know, newsletter subscribers or website visitors they have, and they need to be huge numbers. Like, I'm talking, in most cases, like, starting off with a million social media followers or something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, you mentioned blurbs. Do you want to hear in a query letter that a writer has access to certain writers who are likely to give him or her blurbs? Is that something that is of interest, or do you want to see the actual blurb with the query or with the book proposal?
Both, honestly. I mean, everything the author can put out there on the table, they should. If they have a list of potential endorsers for the book, that's great. I'm happy to see a list of best-selling authors. Or if they have a blurb in the bank, that's even better, because, frankly, in approaching a book publisher and saying, this is the list of best-selling authors who this author knows in some way and will potentially be approaching to endorse the book, or they've promised to give a blurb, you know, the publisher's not really going to believe it fully until there's an actual blurb already in hand. Mm-hmm. So if an author can approach an agent with one or two or even three blurbs already in hand, that's great. They're already off to a good start.
I guess from a writer's point of view, there's this line between, you know, promoting yourself in the way that you need to gain an agent's representation or to gain a publisher, and hype, right? I mean, you know, like where's that line between, you know, reasonable self-promotion and worthiness and kind of overdoing it?
Well, I would say there has to be more hype to the nonfiction, obviously, because we talked about platform.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, again, going back to fiction, at the end of the day, despite the blurbs, despite all the feathers the writer might have in their cap, the words on the page need to do all the talking. That's what it will come down to. I mean, we could have some amazing blurbs from a writer, but if the book is not well written, then my hands will be tied with a publisher.
Does that hold for memoir as well? Would you put memoir and fiction sort of in the same category that way?
I think to a large extent, memoir, again, because it's sharing some qualities with fiction, should be well written, you know, will have a narrative aspect to it. Not tends to be not as important as it is in fiction. In other areas of nonfiction, you know, it's more so driven by the subject matter. So, you know, who is this author? How are they an authority on the subject? You know, people are seeking out a particular book because of what it's about, or maybe who it's written by. And so that's when, you know, I'm not saying it shouldn't be a well-written book, but it becomes less important because people are seeking out a particular idea.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about novels that follow a popular release? And I'm thinking, you know, Gone Girl came out, and then later there was Girl on the Train, and now there seem to be all these novels with the word girl, woman, wife, sister in them, and that seem to be written for the market, maybe not, and probably not, but, you know, these titles all kind of are following a track, and I'm wondering if that's a good thing, writing along what appears to be a trend, or are these types of novels perennials?
I think it's a very tricky thing when you see a trend taking shape in commercial fiction. You always want to be creating waves wherever you can. That's obviously the best place to be. Like, for instance, when 50 Shades of Grey happened, the best person to be was E.L. James.
Mm-hmm.
Or, at the very least, you want to be riding the crest of the wave with E.L. James. So maybe you wanted to have been Sylvia Day or someone like that. When you're sort of riding out behind the wave, you've kind of missed it. And I think that's why when you see these trends taking shape, you really got to be one of the next few people in line. Obviously, there's a big hunger or appetite among publishers and readers for more of these books. But at a certain point, the publishers begin to kind of get fatigued a bit. You know, right now, I think where a lot of publishers are looking in the kind of mystery crime thriller space is sort of for the next crawdads kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Delia Owens book,
yes,
where the crawdads sing. So you see a lot of people looking for coming-of-age novels. It's like To Kill a Mockingbird all over again.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of these books, whether they were the Gone Girl kind of book or another kind of book, they've always been around. Sometimes it's just that there's an audience or a readership which is underrepresented in some way, and they have an appetite for this kind of book, and their needs not being met. And then, unwittingly, a publisher publishes a book that sort of feeds that need, and it creates a bestseller, and then suddenly there's another wave. I think a really good example of that is Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. No one could have seen that book coming because Dan Brown's editor, Jason Kaufman, had moved from St. Martin's Press to HarperCollins to Knopf at Random House, and took Dan Brown with him each time because he was believing in that author. He's the same editor who published the books that the TV show Dexter
yes.
were based on. But he believed in Dan Brown, even though at the time Dan was what we would call like a mid-list author. You know, he was doing okay. He wasn't like a huge best-selling author. And when Random House published The Da Vinci Code, it just became an overnight bestseller, and other publishers were trying to comb through their list, find the same kind of book, and at the same time figure out how this bestseller came about. And through a lot of their research, they found that on the nonfiction side of things, a lot of readers were interested in conspiracies having to do with Mary Magdalene and the Catholic Church. And they realized right away that those readers couldn't find a book like that in the fiction space. And so they had to seek that out among various nonfiction books. And when a fiction book just came about that met their need, it was a bestseller.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting how books become bestsellers. I mean, that's one example of you can't make it happen. I mean, I suppose publicity helps, and you know, having an active publicity department that is, you know, contacting everybody, just everybody and anybody making a book, you know, the book they're going to focus on. And yet, at the same time, that doesn't necessarily work.
Sure, it's a very, in a lot of ways, it's a very organic thing, that in that, on the one hand, kind of like what you allude to, sure, a lot of it has to do with people and their excitement for a book, you know, what the in-house enthusiasm among the marketing and publicity team is for an author and a book. Sometimes that can win the day when, you know, an editor at a book publishing house has inspired a lot of enthusiasm for a book. And then other times, there are books where no one could have predicted it would be a bestseller. I'm thinking of, there's this book called You Are a Badass.
Mm-hmm.
I can say that on the show. And it's a nonfiction book, kind of a how-to self-help and self-improvement kind of book that Running Press had published. They didn't expect much of it. You know, the book backlisted, but then became an overnight bestseller, and they pulled it out of the backlist. Now they're doing more books from that author, and it's in a lot of airport stores. So sometimes you can just really be surprised.
It's nice to be surprised.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Mark Gottlieb. He's a literary agent at Trident Media Group in New York City. Do women still read most of the fiction?
I think the readership has, for a long time, skewed more female than male, especially in terms of fiction. In terms of nonfiction, you know, it balances out a little bit more. I think a lot of it, it's hard to say what it really has to do with. Just maybe the different ways in which men and women read, or what they're seeking out, or how things have been for a long time. Maybe that's changing, but you're right to say that most of the readership skews female, and frankly, most of the people who work in book publishing, it also skews more female.
That's true. That's true. Well, you know, what about reading? I mean, I don't know. There's so many books coming out, and there's so many self-published books coming out, and I've become really curious in terms of how self-publishing and self-published books are affecting publishing, in terms of, you know, are agents more important, less important? Are publishers paying more attention to agented submissions because there are so many self-published novels? I mean, how is the whole thing playing out at this point?
So I think there was an ebook boom for a while. And like with any bubble, you know, you had the dot-com bubble and that burst. And then, you know, now you have a lot of others like tech firms. Or the same thing happened with Bitcoin, right? You had to have gotten in early with Bitcoin. I think the same is true of the ebook space. Ebook sales have, by and large, leveled off. The ebook self-publishing space has also become extremely crowded. There's just a glut of material. And, you know, in a sea of books, as an author, you can't just write a good book. You need to be like a marketing guru to really make it stand out. And what has also occurred in that space is that a lot of authors did experience success early on, but found trouble in replicating that success because once that marketplace became crowded and competitive, a lot of these authors were undercutting each other's prices. It's sort of like two gas stations across the street from each other. One sees this one station lower their price, you know, by some cents, and then the other station does the same thing, and it's a race to the bottom until they can't do it anymore because they're cannibalizing their own business. So you have a lot of these ebooks that at this point are being sold for like 99 cents in some cases, and you need to sell a lot of them in order to justify the margins, the price margins on that for it to really make any good business sense. And so I think a lot of authors who were engineered out of the self-publishing space and into traditional book publishing were much better off because they didn't find themselves stuck in one ecosystem of self-publishing. They kind of had their foot in both sides of the saddle. And when the ebook market, like I said, leveled off, they were better off in the end. And then you mentioned, you know, how it affects agents and publishers. A lot of these self-published authors who experience success, they can oftentimes use that as a justification to find an agent and a publisher. You know, any author who has self-published and sold in excess of, I would say, maybe 50,000 copies of their book, that will really pique the interest of most any book publisher.
Isn't that pretty unreal, though, to sell that many self-published books?
I think it's hard to do. I mean, if you sell tens of thousands of copies, that's pretty good. Most any book publisher will be happy with any book on their list that has sold at least 10,000 copies. I would say 50,000 would be phenomenal, but I'm using that number because you have to factor in if the author is selling, you know, cheap ebooks or 99-cent ebooks or at a lower price point, the publisher is going to figure that if they produce a printed book, you know, they could lose some of that audience. So you have to justify that you've sold a lot of these low-priced books as opposed to you know, selling fewer of a higher priced book. I suppose it's the difference between like a Kobe beef burger, like a $25 burger, or selling, you know, a bunch of McDonald's hamburgers. You know, McDonald's can be hugely profitable because they kind of have that Walmart or Amazon effect about them. They have a big footprint and they sell a lot of hamburgers. Whereas a fine dining restaurant can have big margins and good profits, even though they're smaller and nimble, because they're selling the Kobe beef burger for $25. So it's a similar idea.
Have you taken on any books that were self-published, any authors who were self-published?
Certainly. A lot of authors have come out of the self-publishing space I've begun work with and have placed them with book publishers over the years. You know, some examples of those might be, you know, some authors from, I would say, the women's fiction and romance space, where a lot of genre fiction has gone that way. I've placed those authors with both Amazon book publishing imprints and larger publishers, as well as, you know, in foreign markets, with foreign translation publishers and audiobook publishers. And frankly, most book publishers, they won't accept unsolicited material unless it comes by way of an agent. So it's not really most cases that self-published authors are approaching major book publishers and getting scooped up. It's in rare instances that happens. So it hasn't, I wouldn't say it has affected people on the agency side as much, because in a big way, we're really like the on-ramp to the major highway, I would say, of book publishing.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. You mentioned a while back in a query letter, if you see that an author has blurbs or went to a prestigious MFA program. And I wanted to ask you about MFAs. It's something we talk about a lot here on the show. There are so many MFA programs now, and I'm wondering, you know, just how prestigious does it have to be for it to pique your interest in a query letter? I mean, there are just so many. And, you know, I know there are MFA programs starting to close because there's just too many. So what do you think? I mean, how important is that? And does it matter which one?
I mean, again, it's going to be a feather in the cap. And there are people who could have gone to a top 10, very prestigious MFA program. You know, maybe someone came out of the Iowa Writers Workshop, for instance. But if they, you know, are not capable and don't live up to the name of the however prestigious the program is, it doesn't help their case. And then in the opposite terms, if they've, you know, went to one of the other 50 or 100, you know, or more MFA programs in the country, but they're an amazing writer, well, that's something. So I think this title of MFA, while it's really important to people in the literary fiction space, I think what MFA programs really do for people is, on the one hand, it's a feather in the cap, but it opens some doors. It creates networking opportunities. A lot of authors learn to write in a certain way. I don't know if it necessarily can make them a better writer. You know, a lot of that has to do with other factors, in my opinion. Like, I don't know if there are born writers, but, you know, people who are really applying their craft and the art form of writing learn to become better writers than simply, you know, coming out of an MFA program.
Yeah, it's, you know, you got to wonder, especially when so many are so very expensive. Well, the low residency, especially, where you probably will not get funding, and it won't be a free ride. You won't be a teaching assistant, and you're going to go way into debt and probably never make that money back. It's really, it's a big question mark.
It's a really tough thing because, yeah, when you're essentially going for a very high level of an English degree, and after that you have to ask yourself, what do I do with this MFA degree? Do I go into book publishing? Do I become a writer? Do I stay in academia? You know, those are most of the options at that point. Sometimes people apply it in slightly different ways, like maybe they use the MFA to write, you know, I don't know, ad copy, or you know, they take a journalistic approach, or, you know, in slightly different ways. But you're right, it's a big time commitment and cost, and it's something that needs to be seriously considered, you know, by someone who wants to use it for creative writing purposes.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about writing a book proposal? You know, you mentioned, you know, a couple of sample chapters from the book, and then supporting materials. Can you talk a little bit more about that, what you like to see and mistakes you see happening with writers sending you book proposals?
Sure, I could speak to that. And there's also a very good, or I should say helpful, article I wrote online called How to Write a Nonfiction Book Proposal. If you search that in connection with my name, Mark Gottlieb, anyone should be able to find it. Spelling of my last name is G-O-T-T-L-I-E-B, as in boy. It's on this website called, I think, The Right Life, spelled Right, W-R-I-T-E. And it lists off the elements of a nonfiction book proposal, at least what I think goes into a good nonfiction book proposal. But basically, those are things like, you know, a short description, like a 1 to 2 sentence description. Then there's an about the author page, which is maybe one paragraph about the author. There's a section of the book proposal called competitive review, which is basically a listing of the books that, you know, might be similar in the marketplace. Why? There are other sections like a marketing section where the author could propose how the book might be creatively marketed. You know, things like that. And then with that proposal, you accompany that with 2 or 3 sample chapters from the book. And it doesn't have to be the very first 3 chapters. It could be any 2 or 3 random chapters from the book, maybe some of the most interesting chapters that the author wants to feature. And that's basically the type of things that go into a nonfiction book proposal. I think all told, you know, you would have between 50 and 75 pages there of a decently sized proposal.
How important is the comparison list, where you're comparing your book to other books in the in a similar genre or category?
I think that's hugely important. It's become almost necessary in that, you know, again, as mentioned earlier in the show, not only is an editor trying to figure out where does this book go on my list, where does store, you know, in seeing the comparisons of an author's book, they're trying to figure out for themselves how well will this book do. So before they make an offer to an author and their agent, the publisher will run what's called a profit and loss statement or a P&L sheet. And the magic numbers or the imaginary numbers that they think the book could potentially sell, that they're going to plug into this P&L sheet, are going to be the books they feel are similar to that book. Now, an author is much better off having told the publisher what they think the comparisons are, especially if they're bestsellers, than having the publisher do that work for them. And, you know, oftentimes a book publisher will predicate their offer based on how well they think that, that book can do. So, and that becomes even more important later on when a bookstore is saying to a book publisher, like, you know, Barnes & Noble says to the publisher, what are 2 to 3 best-selling books you feel are similar to this one? And the publisher needs to have that information at the ready.
Mm-hmm.
So an author who knows at least a few comps, best-selling titles that are similar to their book, can share that in a query letter. They will be miles and miles ahead in the book publishing process.
And would they need to be recent books, say from the last couple of years, or is that not that important?
I think, again, they should be books published within the last 5 years that were best-selling books, because otherwise it won't be as relevant to the publisher.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm curious if there, in the query letter process, if there are mistakes you see all the time with query letters.
Well, there are plenty of mistakes that I see in query letters. Sometimes I see a query letter that's too short or too long. You know, it should all really fit on one page. I think it's, rather than describing all the myriad problems that I've seen with query letters over the years, it might be simpler if I were to speak about it in opposite terms by telling you what I think goes into a good query letter. I think a good query letter is upfront in 1 to 2 sentences, the hook, or basically the quick elevator pitch of what the book is about, and it should really grab the reader's attention right away and pull them into the rest of the letter. You know, somewhere up front, or at least somewhere in the letter, there could be you know, the comp titles we discussed, 2 or 3 of those. And then maybe a couple of body paragraphs detailing some of the exciting plot details of the book or some kind of description of the book without too many spoilers. And then the last paragraph, I think, is best reserved to the author, listing off relevant writing experience, credentials, maybe what inspired them to write the book or something miscellaneous like that. And the author can list, a link or multiple links to their website or social media pages. Also in the letter, if the author has a list of potential endorsers or blurbs that they've already obtained, that can also go into the letter.
Do you pay more attention if the letter arrives via snail mail?
We don't really accept query letters by way of snail mail.
Mm.
I think that's just become a thing of the past where people used to send self-addressed stamped envelopes and it would come in through the query transom. Now, with the age of the internet, we have an online submissions form. We ask people to fill out the form and select the name of the person they would like to query from our website. There's a list of names there, and they can read about the agents on our website to see who they want to approach. And then the form gets sent directly to us, and at the same time, the website generates a receipt for the writer, letting them know that we've received it, and that if we're interested, we'll be in touch. And it gives them a time frame of when they could expect to hear, things like that.
Do you pay more attention if you get a referral from a current client? And do you actually find clients from the slush pile?
For me, it has been a mixture of things, but I have found a lot of stuff from just cold queries that came in by email or through our website. But people in our industry will tell you that the best stuff comes by way of referrals. Like, a lot of these best-selling authors will, they travel in circles or groups together. They have friends, and, maybe there's an author who's unhappy with their agent, and so they refer that author over to you, There are lots of things like that that come about by way of referrals. Most people will also pay more attention to a referral because if it's coming by way of a client, they have to give it some level of, special attention.
Do you ever look around? Do you read literary journals and approach writers ever?
Occasionally. I mean, the Columbia MFA program, the director of the program there, just sent me, basically a book of their student work, sampling of their work, and so sometimes I'll comb through things like that. I tend to look in a bunch of different places. I regularly check Amazon, and I look at TED Talks and things like that. And reading articles in the newspaper, checking places like BuzzFeed or Board Panda. A mixture of things.
We have a few minutes left. I'm with Mark Gottlieb. I planned to podcast this show, so if you just tuned in or you want to hear it again, best thing to do is to go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, and when it's uploaded, which should be in the next few days, it will land in your inbox and you can listen again. I want to talk for a minute on rejection letters and parsing rejection letters. You get forms that say, sorry, it's not for us. You get notes that say, I didn't connect with the main character. You get all levels of rejections. You sometimes don't hear anything. How should a writer kind of understand what sort of feedback they're getting, if any?
Well, I think rejection, while it can be very difficult, sometimes it can be an important part of an author's growth to learn from, there's any number of things you can take from a rejection letter, but I think at the end of the day, the author will know best. Right? What piece of editorial advice will sit well with them or not, because they're really closest to the work. No one is as close to the work as the writer. Additionally, So I would say that if a writer is seeing a number of editorial responses, and there's a commonality there of two or three people saying the same thing to the writer, you know, you have to take a minute and really listen to that and consider it. It's not like you have to take it on board, but it's important to think about at that point. And then, you know, the other thing I think to take away from rejection letters, too, is not to be discouraged, because it's a highly subjective business that we work in. It's no different than, you know, we could walk into a museum and we could see a painting on the wall, and I were to say to you, I can't believe that painting is hanging in this museum. And you said to me, are you crazy? They probably paid millions of dollars for that painting. It's an Andy Warhol, you know, don't you know who Andy Warhol is? You know, something like that. It's not a fully objective thing. So, and then, you know, among a sea of people who might have rejected a book, all you need is one person to say yes. It's all you need. And I know some of the biggest best-selling authors who we work with here, who experienced a lot of rejection and went on to become a number one New York Times best-selling author.
So when you say a lot of rejection, are we talking about, you know, 10, 20, 30 either agents or publishers that said no before one said yes?
I'm talking about, in some cases, 75 or more. And I know a lot of authors who, again, are number one New York Times best-selling authors who we work with, who they've saved all their rejection letters. They maybe have them pinned to their fridge, and they look at them and smile and nod when they see them.
A writer would never tell you that until most likely after they sign with you and say, you know, this, you know, I tried to get an agent. You're my 75th agent. I tried. I mean,
I don't know if I would recommend that a writer do that, because they could, you know, shake the agent's confidence a little bit.
Right.
But I have had instances like that where there was a book where the author told me 50 agents rejected my book, but you were the one to take it on. And then we placed him with Penguin Books, and we were able to, you know, do a number of other things for him and his book. So sometimes that happens.
Yeah. What about small presses? It seems like it used to be that agents really didn't want to deal with small presses where the advance would be, say, under, I don't know, $7,500 at 10 grand even, because it was too small of an advance. And it does seem that agents are dealing more with small presses, and smaller presses really want to hear from agents as opposed to the writers. I mean, what's been your experience?
I mean, some of that has and hasn't changed. Obviously, everyone wants to be with a big publisher in most cases if they can, because a big five publisher, can pay big advances. They have huge distribution channels, like Penguin Random House has probably the best distribution in the industry over anything, like Ingram or Publishers Group West or whatever distribution channel a publisher is going to use. So that aspect hasn't changed. What has changed is that it had been a difficult year in book publishing. Publishers are taking on fewer books. They're trying to focus their efforts on a few books. And so that leaves very, very few other places where a book can live. And so some agents who are willing to do it, you know, I've, in certain instances, wanted to see a book published, you know, to see it through to publication. I was happy to place a book with a larger independent publisher or a smaller independent publisher to make sure that the book got out there, because sometimes, you know, you can be surprised. You could still have a bestseller at a small independent publisher. It has happened. And would I say a lot more agents are doing it? I don't know. I would say more agents now are probably turning their attention to debut fiction because it's a lot easier to place an author who doesn't have a prior sales track record with a book publisher because the work can speak for itself in a subjective way. You know, a publisher looking at a debut is thinking, there's a 50-50 chance with this author.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if an author somehow has a damaged sales track record, like their sophomore book didn't do as good as their freshman book, you know, then the publisher is a little bit more risk-averse to publishing the book.
It's complicated.
Definitely.
A little complicated. Mark Gottlieb, thank you so very much for being on the show. Yeah, there's been so much information that you've shared with us. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed my time.
Thanks, Mark. That was Mark Gottlieb. His agency is Trident Media Group in New York City. And that's all the time we have for now. Come back next week, 9 a.m. Pacific time. And Marie will be here, most likely. And we'll give you more authors, agents, poets, everything. But don't forget to keep yourself in the chair. Have a great week.